This is the Sophia Mare Studios podcast. Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Raven Puffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, tarot card exercises, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous host, and other listeners, join the Discord server for Sophomere Studios.
And to support the podcast and gain access to exclusive bonus features, consider joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/sophiamarestudios, all lowercase.
Thank you for tuning in, grab your butterbeer, and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Raven Puffs. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today we're covering Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, chapters 17 and 18, Bathilda's Secret, and... what is the name of the other one? I didn't write it in my little notepad.
Oh, Hellfire. The Life and Lies of
Albus Dumbledore. Yes. So in these ones, we get super horror.
What'd you say? We get super what?
Horror. The genre.
Horror. Okay. Okay. The things we were talking about pre-mic made me think of, you said a different word that started with a W.
No, we were.
Okay. Okay.
Not this genre. Not wrong no. genre.
Okay. Yes, we do. Yeah. In this first chapter that we're reading today.
Mm-hmm. And then the pristine image of Albus Dumbledore is tainted. I'm curious, does this make your loyalty to Dumbledore or your perception of Dumbledore waver in the slightest?
I mean, I don't know. I've like constantly given him a pass because I'm like, there's got to be a reason. Like, I just don't think he's. I mean, sure. I think we've all done some. Maybe I'm just. Let me speak for myself. I've done some dumb things in my younger age. I don't know. He is flawed, but I still forget him. Maybe. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think there's more to the story. That's what I thought.
Yeah, that's always your go-to. There's more.
It is because it's usually the case. Usually is more that I'm like, there it is. So, yeah. Yes.
So, chapter 17, you know, pick up where we left off. They're leaving the cemetery from visiting his parents' graves, and they can sense that someone is watching them.
Yes.
But can't quite figure out who, and then they're walking down the street, and, you know, beforehand, they just saw, like, the monument of, or just the statue of James Lily and then him as a little baby. But then when they get close enough, they see the actual ruins of the cottage that the Potters lived. It's been left, you know, intact for the most part, and it's, you know, it's still standing, but there's just this huge part of the second floor that's been blown to pieces, and Harry surmises that must have been where his nursery was and where the killing curse like ricocheted and backfired.
And if I understood it correctly, it's like they're not really doing anything about it because it's serving as a memorial, but there is also like maybe some residual not so great magic around it. Is that right?
Yeah, that's possible. And you know, a little sign comes up. It rises out of the ground when they touch on the gate, and it's like, on this spot, on the night of 31st October 1981, Lily and James Potter lost their lives. Their son Harry remains the only wizard ever to have survived the killing curse. This house, invisible to Muggles, has been left in its ruined state as a monument to the power of Potters and as a reminder of the violence that tore apart their family.
It's pretty intense. It also kind of reiterates the like importance of the Potter family that they're not taking. I feel like sometimes I would forget when we read this, you know, just like his legacy within the wizarding world, it was always kind of, I know it was a big deal, but this little things like this, or they're not really little things, kind of show the impact of Lillian James and Harry surviving the killing curse too.
Yeah, because You know, because in essence, well, I'm just trying to think. In essence, that's the same as, like, surviving a nuclear bomb.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
Like, if you were, like, directly in the vicinity or, like, again, surviving a volcano, it's like surviving some sort of explosion of great magnitude and, like, coming back unscathed.
Only with a little scar.
Yep. And so people have written some graffiti, and it's like, good luck, Harry, wherever you are. If you read this, Harry, we're all behind you. Long live Harry Potter. And Harry is very touched by that.
He is very touched, but Hermione, ever the, like, rule follower, is like, they shouldn't have written on the sign. It's like, Hermione.
Well, I can't mention it because we're not there yet in the book. So I'll retract my comment because I don't want to spoil anything.
Oh, no. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because people would have been furious if I had spoiled that. So, and then they hear this muffled figure hobbling up to them. And who is it? But they surmise it is Bathilda Bagshot.
Yeah, she's kind of a mess.
She's kind of a mess. And she can see them through, you know, they're underneath the invisibility cloak.
Yeah, but she can see in, and they are still, are they still disguised as,
yeah, they're still polyjuiced as muggles.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Which was very disconcerting in the audiobook, because Jim Dale was, like, changing their voices to be of their disguised muggle selves, and it's like, just use their real voices, man.
Yes, he was, I remember that, too.
I can't remember him using those voices while they were in disguise. Can't help makes me wonder, is are there two versions? But I don't know. Maybe.
Hmm.
But and Harry, being a dummy, he just brushes it off as, oh, she's like Dumbledore's friend. Like, she has supreme magical powers, just like Dumbledore did. It's okay. It's fine.
Yeah. Yeah, a little too trusting here, just because of the proximity to Dumbledore, I guess.
Yeah, well, you know, I think it shows how much, you know, particularly catfishing, like, love scams, but any sort of scam, I think it's a testament of, like, self-delusion, like, when we're desperate or really want something so bad that we'll just, you know, we'll believe whatever we want to believe.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, and in this instance, Harry, and even now by Hermione, they're just so desperate for some sort of, like, you know, breakthrough, because they've got this horcrux and they don't know what the fuck to do with it.
Right.
They're just
right.
So desperate because they're clinging to this hope that maybe the Sword of Gryffindor is it, that Dumbledore left it for them somewhere in Godric's Hollow.
Because I've
read one fan fiction where, again, certain things changed, you know, so certain things didn't quite, you know, happen the same way. But because of that, when they go to the in that fanfic, it's, you know, when they go visit the cottage of the Potters, they actually go inside, and the things that were left to in Dumbledore's will to them, that's where they get it. Someone leaves it for them because things didn't happen where they could get it from Scrimgeour.
Interesting.
So in that version, there was stuff waiting for them in Godric's Hollow, even though it was not the sword. But not in canon version.
But not in this version.
And canon version, again, so desperate for the Sword of Gryffindor. But as we come to know, it ain't there. So they follow Bathilda. And again, when we go into, like, her cottage, like, I immediately think of that show Hoarders.
Oh yeah, that's I was thinking of Mrs. Havisham from Great Expectations. It's kind of like the vibe I got from her.
I think that's giving Bathilda way too much credit in terms of just pure hygiene, because Miss Havisham's is nuts, but there still is an elegance, again, to her cobwebbed chandeliers. Like, this is like mold, like, they can smell rotting meat. There are these huge piles of, like, dirty laundry. It's, like, gross in so many ways. And again, like, dummies, they are dismissing it because they're just going off of what Aunt Muriel said, that she's just not, that as an old woman, she's not 100% there. Like,
yeah. There, I mean, like, the level of filth that they're talking about is, I thought they were going to stumble on a dead body, but no. Because of the smell, I was like, Maybe that's where we're going. But
well, we do get a dead, we do stumble upon a dead body. It's just being magically animated right now.
Yes. Yes. But I mean, I guess like the smell, because she smelled when they walked up to the, her too. I'm not going to overthink this. It reeks and it's a mess.
It's a reek. And again, there are just a lot of red flags because, you know, I can't even say with certainty because again, when I first read this, it was so long ago that I myself was as suspicious, but just reading it again, they are just ignoring so many things because they're just so desperate for a breakthrough.
Yeah. Yeah. They're going in this pretty blind, which I feel like as the reader, you kind of are like, well, that's a red flag and that's a red flag. But they need a win and they get quite the opposite of that.
Yeah. And so, and during all this, Harry finds a picture of the thief that he saw in his vision of Voldemort interrogating Grigorovich, the thief who stole the wand or whatever from Grigorovich.
I caught your yawn. Yes. The picture. Where did I go?
Yeah. And we don't fully realize who it is until the next chapter, but he knows it and he's like asking Mathilda, who is this guy? Who is this guy? And again, she's not answering them. She's not talking.
Yeah. She's not like mute. And I was like, does she speak another language that there she's not understanding? And then I was like, oh no, that's a show I watched last night. So,
Well, we learn what's going on now, but it's clever. Harry, the writer, cleverly uses it as Cum called Mathilda from the next room and Hermione jumped and clutched Harry's arm. And so that's an indicator of, you know, Harry's not picking it up, that she's speaking and is something only he can understand. So he's not fully registering that what Hermione heard is far more sinister than what he just hears a word, but she's hearing crazy ass hissing probably.
Yes, yes. Yes, yes, yes.
Yep. And again, and Hermione is finally like, you know, she wants me to go upstairs alone. And Hermione's like, why?
Right. This part probably made me the most angry. It's like, you know, and he's like, it's fine. It's fine. It's like, dude, have you not lived your own life for the past several years? Like,
and just the sense of she's just an old woman. We can overpower her.
I was annoyed with this because I feel like nothing is as it seems and he should know that. Shoot, he is in a situation right now where he's not who he seems. So they're just desperate. I think that's kind of like the point you reiterated. They so bad want this that they're willing to kind of be like, that's probably fine.
Yeah, probably fine. The road to hell is littered with, it's probably fine.
Yes, it is. I think so.
And then she gets him upstairs and she says to him, you are Potter? Yes, I am. She nodded slowly. And then he felt a leap of joy and spoke in a high, cold voice, hold him.
Yeah, this part was creepy. Like,
have you got anything for me? He asked. And so she points to this huge pile of laundry. And again, you think there's going to be like a corpse, like wrapped around like defecated clothes and like all sorts of disgusting but what we get is also quite disgusting.
It is quite disgusting. Yes.
So out of the corner of his eye, Harry sees Mathilda shift and realizes that he saw it out of the corner of his eye. Panic made him turn and horror paralyzed him, and he saw the old body collapsing and the great snake pouring from the place where her neck had been.
I'm visualizing that's kind of a lot.
Yeah. Interesting notion of it was the corpse like hollowed out magically, like.
I was thinking. Yeah, I won't be critical, but I thought there might have been a different way that could have like expelled the snake.
Yeah. Again, the only way I think it could be grosser is if the snake head came out of her mouth.
That's the way I thought it was. That's the way I was like, that would make sense. But
yeah. So snake struck him, and of course, kicking the snake. Hermione has to come up, And he hears in his mind, like, yes, yes, hold you, hold you.
Yeah. And I mean, it's pretty evident that this is the big name, Big V.
Big V's snake, Nagini.
Yes, Nagini.
You know, and again, it's the, well, again, with all the thrashing, obviously Hermione doesn't want to kill Harry too, you know, but yeah, if only they had been able to kill Nagini.
Yeah, yeah, this is quite a lot. I think then this is where this is eventually going, this whole like tumble, because it's for a minute it's like Harry blacks out basically, and then we get basically a flashback to the night that his parents were killed.
Yep. And so yeah, he's coming, Hermione, he's coming. And so she shrieks, you know, she blows stuff up. And so it's a very interesting, you know, that Harry's connection with Voldemort, because he and Hermione are like jumping out the window, but in his mind he sees Voldemort watching the back of him and Hermione jumping out the window before they apparate away.
Yeah.
And then scary. Yeah, and then Harry blacks out and we get this whole sequence of Voldemort's memory of the night he killed the Potters.
Yeah, and I mean, making even more evident the sacrifice his mom tried to make, but I mean, they both died. I feel like this is the story that we've been kind of we know, but it's filled in now.
And so, because it's on Halloween, and there are literally kids like dressed as pumpkins, like walking around, and one of them is like, "Nice costume, Mister," and he looks up at Voldemort. And Voldemort, you know, it says, "One simple movement and the child would never reach his mother, but unnecessary, quite unnecessary." So it's just interesting, again, the notion of how much of Voldemort indulges in sadism for the hell of it, or does he only indulge in sadism as a means to make an example if it serves a greater purpose? Because, again, as we often bring up, his comparing him with President Snow.
Yeah, yeah.
So, maybe just because he doesn't want to focus on any of the chaos, obviously, that just killing a kid in the middle of the street would cause. He has a very specific goal in mind. Because I tend to think, what? You love killing children.
It's like your favorite thing. Yeah, I think you're right. I think he has like the big prize. It's not worth it at this point in time, but otherwise he'd probably just be like picking off kids left and right.
Yeah, and their little waddling pumpkin.
It's very sad.
So Voldemort, you know, he sees the Potters, you know, in the window, comes in, and it's interesting, this dynamic, because Harry has always been told, oh, your father was so brave, like he held off Voldemort, trying to let your mother get away. But as we see, like, he didn't have his wand on him, ran into the door, ran into the hallway, and just Voldemort takes him out immediately.
Yeah, he's gone pretty quick. It's like, there's not a lot to that. The more dramatic scene is with his mom.
Yeah, and she, she's barricading herself in the, again, I don't know if there was a window, like, I'm just thinking, there was no, why upstairs to to the nursery, I wonder, like, wasn't there, like, a back door, like, a kitchen back door that she could have run through, or, like,
go ahead.
You just have a funny expression on your face.
Yeah.
No, I'm just thinking because it's in a lot of people's headcanon, and Amanda and Kevin have discussed this, is a lot of people, myself included, do not think that spontaneously this blood magic that protected Harry, like, spontaneously manifested itself because Lily made this sacrifice. Because there are surely been other instances where, you know, witches or wizards have tried, you know, sacrifice themselves to protect their children. So a lot of people suspect, myself included, is that there was a very specific spell that Lily performed, maybe some super ancient blood magic, that it's like, if this really goes south, I know my son will be okay if I die for him. So a lot of people suspect that there was an intentionality to her sacrifice and her knowing that was going to happen because she she deliberately took steps towards it, not that it just magically happened. And oh, the power of love. Like, she actually, like, yeah, the power of love. And this is a spell I found and I'm going to use it.
Yeah, the power of planning, I guess. Or I don't know.
Women do, of course, and not the men.
Yeah, that's very true. So
the only way I can justify why not her just trying to run away from the house in some other capacity, because, you know, she knows if she dies trying to flee, then maybe the spell won't work. She has to make a very intentional sacrifice, so she knows she has to stay.
Okay.
So anyway, that's how I'm trying to rationalize this to keep my head canon in order.
That's fine. I think that works, and I'm not going to question it too terribly much.
Mm-hmm. And, yep, and then what do you think of... Voldemort immediately goes to kill James and just does it without thinking, but he allows Lily the opportunity to step aside. And, you know, something he did not afford to James Potter. What do you think that is about?
Okay, so Voldemort, Tom Riddle, right? Same dude. This is what I'm thinking. Tom Riddle predates Lily and James going to Hogwarts, right? He's older than Lily and James.
He's even older than, like, Bellatrix, Lucius. He's even older than all of them. Like, he's Hagrid's age. As far as we know, only Hagrid was in school with. Voldemort is closer to McGonagall in age.
Okay. So that was going to be my initial theory. It was some sort of, like, interest in Lily, which
I'm sure somebody else might out be. There, but gross.
I know somebody else might be interested in Lily. A little bit of spoiled there. I don't think it's because he's like, you know, oh, she's a woman, so I'm going to spare her or, you know, like give her a chance. I mean, I don't think he's like that chivalrous. No. I'm not really sure.
Because there is one thing to consider. I wouldn't necessarily define it as chivalry, but it's more, it may be a is the possibility of a Freudian slip where he knows his mother died having birth, like didn't fight for him. And seeing again, not that it diminishes anything of all the horrible atrocities, but again, a Freudian slip of here's a woman who is willing to die, you know, is willing to die for her son when my mother didn't.
So the only other thing that I'm thinking about is, because he tells her to stand aside and he wants to kill Harry, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, moreover, Lily. So yeah. I think, like, reading that as him sparing her is almost, like, generous to him. Mm-hmm. I feel like the bigger torture is watching your child be killed. So maybe he really just wanted to, like, twist the knife or something.
That is also possible. But, yeah, so he decides to... So he gets tired of her, you know, begging, kills her. And yeah, and again, there's also the possibility of going back to the headcanon of thinking that there was something she specifically did to spell-wise, ritual-wise, to prepare for this. And there's a sense of, could he possibly know about it? Like, maybe there's a sense of him that, you know, knows this sort of magic exists, but thinks it's so rare and so, like, no one else could, like, think of it, you know?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. There's a lot of ways to interpret these actions, I think.
Yeah, so, but ultimately he decides to kill her and looks into the voice face and it's like the child began to cry. It had seen he was not James. He did not like it crying. He had never been able to stomach the small ones whining in the orphanage.
That was very strange to me. Like his, like, he didn't like that noise. Why? That's what, like, I don't get it.
Well, because even Mrs. Cole, the head of the orphanage, tells Dumbledore he hardly ever cried, like, as a baby. Like, I think it's the typical, like, toxic masculinity that crying is weakness. And he never affords himself to look weak in any way, shape, or form and loathes it in others.
I just figured, like, he would probably be, like, psyched about that. Like, children crying, oh, it's so beautiful. Like, I guess that's a little too cliche for a villain, but
yeah. And then he tries casting the killing curse, but it's like, and then he broke. He was nothing but pain and terror, and he must hide himself, not here in the rubble of the ruined house where the child was trapped and screaming, but far away, far away.
Traumatic.
And so Harry wakes up from this dream, trance, stupor, whatever.
Yeah.
And it's been several hours where they're back in the tent. Hermione's taking care of him. And, you know, he's like, and also during this whole endeavor, the Horcrux has been like acting up while Harry's been wearing it during the whole episode with Mathilda. And it got to a point where Hermione had to like sever the locket from his skin.
Ugh. So, but then they put it away. They're like, yeah, we don't need to wear this for a while.
Yeah, don't need to wear it. And then the snake bit you, but I've cleaned up the wound. And then what we got? And then, you know,
she's just a plain old snake, right? She's not a basilisk or anything.
No, she's
like
not
that.
A basilisk. She's as normal as a huge venomous snake, evil lord's venomous snake can be, I guess.
Okay, she's just a snake. Like, there's just, okay.
Yeah, no, but she's not a basilisk where, like, she stares at things and they turn to stone, no.
Okay, all right. Or her teeth aren't, like, super special or anything. Okay.
Well, she is poisonous, but again, she didn't grip him to, like, poison him because she knows Daddy wants to finish Harry Potter off himself.
Right. Oh, got it. Okay.
And Harry's like, you know, we shouldn't have gone. You were right. And she's like, you know, I wanted to go too. I really thought Dumbledore might have left us the sword there for you.
We will discuss this in the next chapter, but I'm a little like, Harry has been frustrating me with his like Dumbledore things here.
Mm-hmm. And what do we got?
His wand is broken.
Yes, that the biggest blow is his wand. It's been cracked in half and it's only hanging together by the tiniest bit of the phoenix feather, which is now visible in at its core.
Yeah, and Hermione has tried to repair it, but it can't. She can't get it to fix.
No, she cannot get it to fix, and her face glazed with tears. Hermione handed over her wand and he left her sitting beside his bed, desiring nothing more than to get away from her. So, you know, not that he shouldn't be sad over his wand, but I, both here and then moving into chapter 18, The Life and Lies of Albus Dumbledore, I get ticked off with Harry being so mean and standoffish with Hermione over this. It's like, dude, you almost died.
You almost died. Your friend is trying to help. You're putting her in harm's way. And you're being kind of a weenie about Dumbledore. Like, that was driving me nuts. Ugh, Dumbledore didn't tell me this. That's kind of like, maybe, like, the man was 600 years old. A lot of stories. You're at like least, four.
at least he was like 115 or some shit like that.
Yeah. Ridiculous.
So he just thinks about all the pain, all the scars he's gone through in his life, and he's never felt more vulnerable or weakened as, you know, losing his wand. Because in his mind, he sees that he's lost not only the twin core protection that he had, but even when he, you know, as Hermione would say, it's the wizard, not the wand that right. houses all the magic, but Harry is still adamant that, you know, his wand spinning around and shooting gold fire at Voldemort was like certainly not him, and the wand was doing something, and now he feels like, you know, I don't have that protection either anymore.
I mean, I don't know what to tell you, Harry. You don't need to take it out on your friend who was trying to fix it for you, and you're just being a diva.
And had to blow up everything to get the snake off you because you were dumb enough to follow this corpse when it was very obvious in her house that no one had lived there for weeks.
Yes, this freaking corpse that was reanimated by a snake. Like, gross. That's pretty nasty. Yeah, I don't know what to say. I'm very annoyed with Harry in these chapters, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, he's such a diva. He's very tempted to throw away the old snitch that Dumbledore gave him. And his fury at Dumbledore broke over him now like lava, scorching him inside, wiping out every other feeding out of sheer desperation. They had talked themselves into believing that Godric's Hollow held answers, convinced themselves that they were supposed to go back, that it was all part of some secret plan laid out for them by Dumbledore. But there was no map, no plan. Dumbledore had left them to grope in the darkness, to wrestle with the unknown and undreamed of terrors, alone and unaided. Nothing was explained. Nothing was given freely. They had no sword, and now Harry had no wand. And he had dropped the photograph of the thief, and it would surely be easy now for Voldemort to find out who he was. Voldemort had all the information. Oh, that's another thing they felt they've really screwed up, is that they gave him that, you know, Voldemort didn't seem to know who this guy was either, and now he can put it together.
Yeah. This is a lot of whining, Harry. Like, whatevs.
Yeah, this is a lot of whining, and so Hermione comes in, gives him some tea, and she apparently Hermione took The Life and Lies of Albus Dumbledore while Harry was having a little chat with Bathilda Nagini puppet thing.
Reanimated corpse, yeah. Yes. And Harry swiped the picture, too. I don't know if that was in that earlier chapter, right? Yeah. He just kind of, like, slipped it in his pocket. Okay.
And it's a copy that was sent to Bathilda by Rita Skeeter herself. Dear Batty, thanks for your help. Here's a copy of the book. Hope you like it. You said everything, even if you don't remember it, Rita.
That's kind of shitty, like, Rita. So, I mean, and I know we talk about that too, but, like,
again, why couldn't Rita just be a novelist?
Yeah.
If she wants, like, just stop, if she wants ruining the drama. Lives.
Yeah. Maybe she's just not that creative. That's why. Like, she's, I don't know.
But yeah. Anyway, so you're still really angry at me, aren't you? Said Hermione. He looked up to see fresh tears leaking out of her eyes and knew that his anger must have shown. No, I know it was an accident. And so here we get a little bit of, like, so they decide to read a chapter out of Rita's book. And big revelation. The thief in question is Grindelwald.
Grindelwald. That's my Grindelwald voice. Yes. Wow.
Gellert Grindelwald. And they read the chapter where, in essence, in her very Rita Skeeter way, gives a summary that Dumbledore was, you know, again, the creme de la creme at Hogwarts. So many awards, so many accolades, like, so brilliant, so bright. He was at the Leaky Cauldron with Doge, about to head off to Greece for, like, a grand tour, as young men were wont to do in between the 17th and early 20th centuries. But that gets called off because Kendra, his mother, dies.
Rip.
Yep. And so he stays home to look after Aberforth as well as Ariana, although Ariana still is kept secluded, you know, as a recluse in the house, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
What is
there's just gotta be more to that story. That part's really bothering me.
Yeah. And I think, you know, again, we're talking about Harry whining. A part of me feels like, because of just of Harry's own experience with the Dursleys, honestly, I feel like Harry could get over, okay, maybe he was a white supremacist in his youth, but he, like, reformed and he did a lot of good things in his older age. I think he could honestly understand that aspect more if there wasn't the Ariana bit, because obviously he identifies so well. He identifies and relates so personally to what it's being said was Ariana's experience.
Yes, you're exactly right, and that's something I didn't even put together, but that he's definitely projecting, and that's probably hurting his heart. And I wonder if that's why Dumbledore didn't tell him that, you know, talk to him about that.
Because I think there's a part of, even though he did get an intellectual explanation, Dumbledore told him at the end of book 5, I kept you with the Dursleys because that's the only way that this blood protection your mother gave you works. You have to stay with her blood relative. So even though he got a intellectual explanation for why he stuck with the Dursleys, but there's this part of him, it's like, there's probably a part of him, it's like, how could he leave me with those people? And it's like, well, it's easier for Harry to believe, like, how could Dumbledore leave me with these people if he already did it to someone else?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So, anyway, so Kendra dies. Albus is stuck in Godric's Hollow, and Bathilda comes in saying that her grandnephew, Gellert Grindelwald, you know, decides to come to Godric's Hollow for the summer. And even he's all up in the Dark Arts, and even Durmstrang, which is already known for the Dark Arts, couldn't handle Grindelwald and expelled him.
Ooh, it's hardcore.
Yeah. So Bathilda has her grandnephew Grindelwald come, and he and Dumbledore seem to really hit it off.
I mean, this is obviously, I guess, I'm inferring this as a romantic relationship, but.
Yeah,
something in the wording.
All the cultural osmosis from pop culture, like, yeah, yes, this, you know, this was a romantic relationship, and which they only finally admitted to it in Secrets of Dumbledore, the third one in Fantastic Beast.
Wow. Okay.
Which a lot of people, you know, understandably, were kind of pissed off that they were still leaving it ambiguous, trying to queer bait without committing.
Yeah, that's a fun thing that people need to stop doing.
Yeah, so the most poignant thing about this friendship between Albus Dumbledore and Gellert Grindelwald is that there is a letter from Albus. Gellert, your point about wizard dominance being for the Muggles' own good, this, I think, is the crucial point. Yes, we have been given power, and yes, that power gives us the right to rule, but it also gives us responsibilities over the ruled. We must stress this point. It will be the foundation stone upon which we build. When we are opposed, as we surely will be, this must be the basis of all our counter-arguments. We seize control for the greater good, and from this it follows that where we meet resistance, we must use only the force that is necessary and no more. That was your mistake at Durmstrang, but I do not complain, because if you had not been expelled, we would have never met, Albus.
He's 17 when he writes this, right? He's a teenager.
And that exactly, Hermione's just like, he was young. And first, before we get into their commentary on it, so it seems that they had, you know, they were having pals, but then Ariana dies, and Bathilda describes it as Gellert Grindelwald comes home like really upset and flustered, and immediately takes a portkey and skips town.
Peace.
Yeah, he pieces out, leaving Albus and Aberforth, his brother, to bury the sister, and as we already know from earlier in the book, that, you know, Aberforth is so upset that he punches Albus in the face at the funeral.
It happens. Punching people at funerals.
Weddings and funerals, that's where it happens.
That's in the wizarding world, that's where it all goes down, pretty much. And Quidditch matches.
Yep. Yeah. Neither Dumbledore nor Grindelwald ever seems to have referred to this brief boyhood friendship later in life. However, there can be no doubt that Dumbledore delayed for some 5 years of turmoil, fatalities, and disappearances his attack upon Gellert Grindelwald. Okay, I made a note of this because, again, the fact that Dumbledore defeated Grindelwald in 1945, I've always, even as like a 12-year-old reading this from the Chocolate Frog card in book one, I always inferred that, okay, Dumbledore basically stopped World War II. You know, that there are direct allegories. So if it's 5 years, then that means, again, that exactly, you know, technically, you know, World War I, at least in Europe, is said to have begun in 1939 with the invasion of Poland. But obviously, many things factored in were, like, most powers didn't probably start in earnest, like, fighting until 1940. So, yeah, so literally the entire span of World War II, it suggested that Dumbledore, like, even though Grindelwald was doing a lot of shitty things, Dumbledore didn't do anything until finally 1945.
Do you think, because they're romantically involved, it had something to do with that? I do. Mm-hmm.
That is possible. Yep. So the chapter ended, and Hermione's like, you know, Harry, listen to me. This is Rita Skeeter. And from that, it looks like Dumbledore gave him the idea. They said for the greater good, and that for the greater good was even carved over the entrance of Numengard. what's new Normanguard, the prison Grindelwald had built to hold his opponents. He ended up there himself once Dumbledore had caught him. Anyway, it's an awful thought that Dumbledore's ideas helped Grindelwald rise to power, but on the other hand, even Rita can't pretend that they knew each other for more than a few months or one summer when they were both really young, and I thought you'd say that, said Harry. I thought you'd say they were young. They were the same age as we are now, and here we are risking our lives to fight the Dark Arts, and there he was in a huddle with his new best friend plotting the rise to power over the Muggles.
And I say, love makes people stupid. That's what I say. So I think it's great to think everybody has a perfect moral compass as teenagers or whatever, but I think love is blinding, and that, you know, I don't know. I mean, also, yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of with Hermione on this. I, you know, and I know Harry points to, like, Hermione says it was Rita Skeeter, and then Harry's like, well, that was his letter, you know, but he was 17. Sorry, everybody.
Yeah. And it's like, alone? He wasn't alone. He had his brother and sister for company. His squib sister he was keeping locked up. I don't believe it, said Hermione. She stood up. Whatever was wrong with that girl, I don't think she was a squib. The Dumbledore we knew would never, ever have allowed. The Dumbledore we thought we knew didn't want to conquer Muggles by force, Harry shouted, his voice echoing across the empty hilltop. He changed, Harry. He changed. It's as simple as that. Maybe he did believe those things when he was 17, but the whole rest of his life was devoted to fighting the Dark Arts. Dumbledore was the one who stopped Grindelwald, the one who always voted for Muggle protection and Muggle-born rights, who fought you-know-who from the start, and who died trying to bring him down. And Hermione goes on to say, Harry, I'm sorry, but I think the real reason you're so angry is that Dumbledore never told you any of this himself.
And he's like, maybe I am. Come on.
Yeah, look what he has asked from me, Hermione. Risk your life, Harry, again and again and again, and don't expect me to explain everything. Just trust me blindly. Trust that I know what I'm doing. Trust me even though I don't trust you. Never the whole truth. Never.
I understand he's wounded by that, but I mean, and I still think Dumbledore has his reasons. I also think it's easy to judge somebody your age when you're that age, but the older you get, you're kind of like you're 17 instead of being like, he was 17 too. It's like, no, when looking at it at like 40, it's like he was 17. Like, yeah. So anyway.
Yeah, he loved you, Hermione whispered. I know he loved you. Harry dropped his arms. I don't know who he loved, Hermione, but it was never me. This isn't love, the mess he's left me in. He shared a damn sight more of what he was really thinking with Gellert Grindelwald than he ever shared with me.
Because you're a child and Grindelwald was his lover. Like, geez, fucking Harry Potter, man. It's making me mad. When ending this chapter, I was like, Harry, I need a break from you right now. That's what I would say to him if he was my friend. I would say, I need to go to the other room. Let's take a minute. You're pissing me off. And I think it's even more evident why Dumbledore would not share this stuff with him. The point that I'm kind of like, all right, you have a point there, Harry, is yes. Dumbledore has asked him to basically risk his life constantly. And why? I don't know. Maybe he's atoning for his sins through Harry. I'm not there yet. So I don't know yet.
Yeah. And so thanks for the tea. I'll finish the watch. You get back in the warm. And that is that. He closed his eyes at her touch and hated himself for wishing that what she said was true, that Dumbledore had really cared.
I think Dumbledore did care, Harry. Ugh, I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of the Arya, as we already discussed, the Ariana bit, where Harry relates and identifies so much with Ariana, or what is being highly suspected about her. And because if Dumbledore had said, like, you know, I had swastikas, like, tattooed, like, I don't know. And this is particularly coming from a position where I've been reading a lot of, you know, stuff about white supremacists, and a lot of the nonfiction books I've been reading has been from former white supremacists, or at least, if not the author, at least being the book containing interviews from, you know, people who previously held those views, and what they've been doing to try to, like, you know, help people not go down that radicalized route. So I'm coming from a place of, you know, a lot of forgiveness, because again, because those people who were previously there, they tend to be more useful and more able to facilitate change than just people who have never been on that side, just commenting from the, you know, externally and haven't, don't know how these people tick.
I agree 100%. I mean, there's also, Dumbledore did change, like, if even if he was, you know, interested in it, he did not remain in it. And I think that speaks to his character as well. So, and how are you going to defeat the dark arts if you don't know anything about it? So in-depth knowledge is probably better to have than just being like, oh, well, the dark arts are terrible and I know nothing about it. So,
mm-hmm. Yep. So, yeah. So, yeah, definitely I'm of the thing if Dumbledore had said, hey, I was kind of into this stuff, but I realized the error of my ways and I changed, then obviously this wouldn't be a blow to Harry in any way, shape, or form.
Right. Yeah.
But anyway, such is the end of chapter 18. And again, people complain about Harry being whiny in book 5. Like, those are justifiable reasons. Like, to me, this is super whiny where it's hard for me to, like, empathize with Harry.
This was trying my patience. I mean, I felt a little bad for being so mad at him, but whatever.
So, with those drama-filled chapters, let us transition to our exercises, and let us first begin with a pretty obvious one for this chapter, Gothic Geek Out.
Bathilda's house is very gothic and gross. It reminds me of this book that I've seen probably on TikTok. I will not read it because it's called like The Slob or something, and it's like a splatterpunk book, and I have no interest in reading that. That's like a little too far for me. But yeah. Ruined, like ruinous.
Yeah. Although, you know, I was poo-pooing originally your original allegory of Miss Havisham, but I think you're right. I think I'm romanticizing Miss Havisham too much, because isn't there a description of like the actual original wedding feast being there?
I think so. And she's like covered in like spider webs and stuff. She's kind of a hot mess and gross.
Yeah, she's a hot mess who hasn't seen sunlight in like 20 years.
So the reason probably that came to mind to me too, I think there's a new Great Expectations coming out, and Olivia, not Olivia Wilde. Famous British actress. She played the Queen.
Olivia Colman?
Yes. Is playing Mrs. Havisham. And I saw like an image of her, and it looks like the way that the book made me think of it. I think I read the book a million years ago. The Helena Bonham Carter one was a little kind of romanticized, I thought.
Yeah, because that's the one I'm thinking of. Like, it is a little romanticized probably, but at the same time, I appreciate Helena Bonham Carter because Helena Bonham Carter is not super old. She's middle-aged, and so she actually was the age, you know, most appropriate to where she would be in the novel, whereas traditionally they always make her so much older, like a super old crone, even though realistically that's not her age in the book. So I appreciate the Helen Bonham Carter version from the age angle, but yeah.
I sent in our chat a picture of Olivia Colman as Mrs. Havisham, and that's kind of what made me, it looks kind of like her, she's in her wedding dress and she looks all kind of deteriorated and gross, but
she looked deranged.
I was like, when I saw that, I was like, wow, that is what that character should look like. So that's kind of that's the vibe that my brain connected to when we were reading about this house, but just, you know, with rotting cakes and stuff.
And then Olivia Colman, the last thing. It's interesting because that's Dickens, and it was just a few years ago, but they did an animated version of Scrooge, A Christmas Carol, like the musical version from the 70s.
Oh, huh, okay.
Yeah, so there's a Christmas Carol version that's animated, and it's a musical, and Olivia Colman does the voice of the Ghost of Christmas Past. And she's really good at it. Like,
She's a great actress. She's good.
Yeah, so anyway, so yeah, I think Miss Havisham is well apt, because I was thinking of the very romanticized Helen Bonham Carter. What I thought of, you know, 13th tale, when, you know, the head of the house, Charlie, I think, goes missing.
Okay.
He gets the news from the asylum that his sister has died. And so he's so distraught. And so he's holed up in his room. And there's finally a point where they break down the door. And again, it's just complete disgusting filth. Like,
yes.
He sees rotting food. And at first they go into the bathroom thinking he'll be there, like, in the tub with, like, slit wrist. And it's all super all really gross, but he's not there.
Yes, that's, I remember that. Ugh, yuck. That was a pretty horrific thing. And that whole horror, just like gross horror. I mean, I don't know. I feel like I'm very particular about it, but like rotting food and things like that. Like, there's a reason that's gross. And I just would rather, I'm like, well, I don't need to read about that. So.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, that's the rotting old woman. I'm trying to think from the snake aspect. I'm looking at my shelf right now. Snake wise, not thinking of anything direct, but
I mean, I don't understand the mechanics of how she I don't know. I guess the body was hollowed out. Like, that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah,
wearing her skin.
Yeah, that's what I immediately think of, is that her innards are just completely depleted.
So it was like a skin suit, like Leatherface or like Hannibal Lecter or something.
Oh, Hannibal Lecter. I knew you were going there.
Yeah, Ed Gein is who I was thinking of. But
although I was watching a video essay of, like, as much of a classic and how much people adore that film, it doesn't serve well in terms of, you know, why are we obsessed with the, like, trans or queer person as, like, the homicidal sociopath.
That is, that is, people are scared of things they don't understand. And I'm guessing that might be the reason that's
But the thing is that even the writer of that story, like, tried to put in some things that, yeah, this is my book, but it's not real. Even the writer knew, like, was trying to counteract what he was, like, kind of with Gone Girl. Like, I know this is, like, not real, you know, but still people don't get it.
Like, backpedal on the trans thing on Wild Bill, or what he was trying to, what was,
well, not, the, he in the book there are a few passages like talk about trans stuff and, you know, trying to make it clear, trying to put some things to reader, like, yeah, like, this isn't a demonization, like, did not necessarily backpedaling, but, you know, trying to make clear that, yeah, he's not a real, like, transgender or whatever,
person.
Something like that. And so even though he, the writer himself, put that in the novel and no one paid attention.
Of course, people will. Yeah, interesting. I never read that book because.
I didn't read it either. I just read the video essay that showed the excerpts, and so anyway, reanimated corpses and, like, ugh, disgusting rooms that haven't been lived in. And I don't know if this is TMI, but when my grandfather died, like, I think it was, I don't know if where my grandmother was, because my grandmother was still alive, but it was at least 8 hours, if not a whole day, and people not being sure. And again, when my mom came to the house, like, it was a hoarding situation.
Oh, well, yeah.
Not with, like, rotting food, but just with a lot of, like, mail and, like, just clutter and stuff, but yeah.
Yeah. Ugh. That's sad. But I think if I'm understanding this right, the point was Bathilda really, she was quirky, but she wasn't a hoarder. Or was she a hoarder, or was that just kind of like a...
No, not necessarily. It was just that she was, her mind, that she was just senile.
She was senile. And she was dead.
Well, yeah, we know she was dead, but I guess the sense is, you know, when someone is senile, like, how much do we attribute senile stuff and other stuff with, like, hoarding and just clearly not being able to take care of yourself, and just they're just so alone that there's no one to, like, keep them in check when things start to get really, really gross.
Yeah.
Again, although that was, like, they were really desperate to excuse all of that.
Yeah. Hermione and Harry were, they really, really wanted,
yeah,
they wanted something, like,
and I think a part of them being that desperate, because if I don't think this would have happened, or even if they were desperate to go to Grog's Hollow, if Ron had been there, if Ron had not left specifically because he was criticizing, you don't know what the hell you're doing, you have nothing to go on. So I think both of them were spurred by the hurt of Ron leaving. Yeah. That fueled that desperation of, we need something.
We really need to prove him, like, we really need to show him up or something, yeah. There was a lot going on. I totally forgot that Ron, like, just was like this and, like, left. I flipped the bird, everybody. Nobody could see that, like, bye, everybody. Interesting. Gross. Yeah. Interesting.
All righty, then. So let's move on to Tarot of the Day. And the interesting one that the Two of Wands. Interesting. I picked a wand card when we lose a very important, iconic wand in these chapters.
Yes, we do.
So what do we got? The Two of Wands takes the spark of inspiration from the Ace of Wands and turns it into a clear action plan. You went through the discovery phase and know what you want to manifest. Now you need to figure out how. You are exploring your options and carefully plotting out the path ahead, accounting for all possibilities and potential challenges. You are open to growth and exploring new territories so long as you maintain a level of certainty that your efforts will work out in the end. When the Two of Wands appears in a tarot reading, you are not ready to make your move. It is more important that you establish a clear plan before proceeding, which they did not do with the film.
No, they did not.
Two of Wands is also about discovery, particularly as you step outside your comfort zone, explore new worlds and experiences. Well, certainly stepping out of their comfort in that disgusting hovel.
Right.
Of rotting meat and mountains of dirty clothes and
side note, that is probably the grossest scene to me in the Southern Book Club's Guide to Slaying Vampires. The reason I didn't like it so much is because there's a scene with like rotting clothes and stuff like that and I was just like almost threw up. Anyway,
oh dear.
Carry on.
Yeah, Two of Wands indicates that you are considering your longer term goals and aspirations and are ready to plan for what you need to do to achieve them. You have already come so far and now you feel ready for a change. This time, with your long-term future in mind, you may be contemplating overseas travel, further education, or a significant career switch. The twos and tarots represent decisions of some sort. With this two, you may make a choice between sticking with what you know or taking a risk. Well, certainly they took a huge risk.
Dumb risks. Like, they, yeah.
Really dumb risks. And yeah, because, yeah, two is always the crossroads. And interesting, because we started with two wands and then we ended up with one.
Yes.
Oh, dear. I'm just trying to think. Let's see, what about the reverse meaning? Like, Two of Wands reverse encourages you to draw your attention inwards and focus on your personal goals. Consider what is truly important to you and what lights you up. You may have headed in one direction only to realize it wasn't in full alignment with your deeper values. I wish they thought of that beforehand.
Yeah.
And well, again, we're talking about all the decisions in regards to trusting Bathilda Bagsage, but are any of those sentiments ringing true about, you know, finding out the stuff about Dumbledore? Or because, you know, definitely Dumbledore was at a crossroads, you know, in his relationship with Grindelwald. And it's also interesting, you know, of Harry being so whiny, because it's not in any way obviously it's not a great look if Grindelwald used some of Dumbledore's terminology, but there's nothing, even as you know, slanderous as Rita is, there's nothing to suggest that Dumbledore himself acted upon and committed certain anti-Muggle crimes. This is something, again, that he was philosophically thinking about, and yeah, maybe it wasn't the greatest stuff, but there's nothing to suggest that that Dumbledore did specifically any anti-Muggle stuff. As far as we know, that is all Grindelwald. And so, like, it's one thing to have those, like, ideas in your youth, and, you know, you got pulled, and again, you got pulled back from it because of Ariana's death and everything, but Harry's carrying on as if, like, he and Grindelwald were doing all the bad shit during World War II, and it doesn't seem that Dumbledore was.
It's like Harry is a mom that was, like, during Columbine, when Columbine happened, and everybody was like, oh, it's because they're playing those video games. They're terrible people, because that's why. It's like, people can play violent video games and not go kill people. You know, I feel like I'm reaching a little bit, but it's kind of like, just because somebody has knowledge of something doesn't mean they're going to do the thing. Again, I'm thinking of our previous conversation.
My brother-in-law is not a reader, but he knows certain historical facts that I don't from playing Assassin's Creed.
Yeah. And
he gets his history from video games.
That, hey, whatever makes you smarter and keeps you engaged, I think that's wonderful.
Yeah. I know you've just opened a floodgate now with the whole, like, video games are bad. Because, where was I going with this? Did you ever watch Super Nanny? I know I'm going on a tangent, but.
Like, maybe an episode or two when it, like, first came
okay,
on.
So, but, yeah, so there was one episode in the rendition where the father, he legitimately had a, you know, the sort of, like, gaming addiction that needed to be addressed. But it was very obvious, you know, in, like, the Super Nanny, in the host, like, demeanor, that's, oh, let's go to the library and read books. And it's like, hey, I read, you know, books are great and stuff. But she definitely was coming from a place of, like, judgment about just all video games are bad, rather than preaching, like, just moderation in general.
That is the thing that people hate the most, is moderation, I think.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So. Anyway, so the two of wands of, you know, Dumbledore and Grindelwald, clearly, even though they were at the same point at one time, clearly veered in completely different directions.
Right. And that's okay. I mean, go through the path of good only. Don't go the Grindelwald path, but.
Yeah. So, anyway, so any further thoughts about the two of wands?
It just to me highlights the establish a clear plan when you said that, and kind of the action plans, things like that, how Hermione and Harry just kind of went in not really having a lot of things based in reality, but mainly based in speculation. And that was not good.
Yeah, which to be fair, because Dumbledore likes to speak in riddles and not just tell them, do this and do that.
That is true. And that is a flaw of his. Probably a bit for protection. See, I can excuse anything with Dumbledore. But, yeah.
Yeah, here. So, now we can move on to the Black Moon astrology cards. And the card I picked at random was one of the element cards. It was the element of air.
All right.
Air. Yeah. Air being the element associated with the House of Ravenclaw.
Oh, very nice. Half our
As you remember from our scholarly Slytherclaw episode of Hogwarts houses and the elements a long, long time ago.
Yes. Gryffindor's fire. Snakes are water. Hufflepuff's earth, right?
Earth, because they have all the food.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
Yep. And so, yeah, air signs are Gemini, Libra, and Aquarius.
I know very few of those signs. That's funny. Anyway. You're an earth sign. Taurus is an earth sign.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I know very few Geminis in my life. Most of the air signs in my life are Libras. My mother, my brother-in-law.
Oh, wow. I have to think about that.
Okay. So the air element is about being objective and becoming mentally inspired. When we think of air, we think of clouds and sky and what connects us to the beyond. Air is all about lofty thinking, being broad-minded and expansive. AKA Ravenclaw.
Yes.
Air sign people, Geminis, Librans, and Aquarians, sometimes cut them off as a little cool and detached. They weigh everything, mull the situation over, and decide what they think. So yeah, so again, air is the sign of engaging in intellectual activity. So it's not like the physical versus the mental or physical versus the emotional, but it's about like cool-headed intelligence versus the emotions of water.
Is Dumbledore an air sign? I forget what his thing is.
I need to look that up. What was Dumbledore's no, house, plan, wand, zodiac sign? He was a Libra,
air, right?
Yep.
Right? Yeah, there we go. Okay, that makes sense, because I feel like they're describing very Dumbledore like themes here.
Yeah, those governed by air signs are mentally inclined and tend to distance the emotions. Air can represent overthinking and distancing the heart and emotions with abstractions and mental puzzle. And it's interesting, only partially related of, you know, I'm an avid follower of the Dark Academia aesthetic on TikTok. And a part of Dark Academia is kind of, you know, shedding light on the elitism of colleges and the dangers in some ways of if you analyze or study something from a completely abstract way, like you lose sight of like your humanity. Some romantics to argue against the Enlightenment, they would pose scenarios of like, oh, the population is too big, let's just eat babies as a means to like poke holes in the hardcore reasoning of those in the Enlightenment, with like, you know, sentimentality does have a role to play in society.
Gosh, that was like quite the thing to say. It reminded me of a movie, but I can't remember what the movie was.
Yeah, when the air element card presents itself in a reading, it is time to put into words what you want, what you desire, and what you expect. The good news is some issues you've been working on a current time and possibly from the past are now being resolved. You are able to face them without pretense, but most importantly, with honesty. Harry doesn't feel that way about Dumbledore right now.
Not at all.
Yep. So, yeah, I'm just trying to think. And again, it's interesting that Dumbledore is a Libra, because obviously the sense of justice is strong with Librans. And so, you know, obviously because, you know, in this, like, this whole series is about prejudice of blood status and who is a better person just based on their pedigree. And Dumbledore, and it's obviously, it's framed in a way where it paints like pure blood wizards as like the oppressors, because obviously wizards are the most powerful and therefore they are the oppressors in comparison to muggles. But, you know, for Dumbledore and for people like Lucius Malfoy and others, they see themselves as victims because they have to live in seclusion, in hiding, and they have to do all these things to accommodate muggles. So to them, they feel like a marginalized group.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
So Dumbledore, in terms of his sense of justice, is making it so that, you know, that wizards don't have to subject themselves to this level of self-censorship.
Yes.
It just leaves a lot to be desired. Or maybe I'm just not that deep of a Potterhead, you know, said no one ever.
I don't think that's the case.
Huh? But I wish there was more expanded upon of like the dynamic between what made it, because again, they keep referring to the International Statute of Secrecy, where like all the wizards, at least in Europe, probably because again, we're in a Eurocentric universe, unfortunately, where everyone got together and decided, okay, we're making the conscious choice to keep the secret, like the Volturi, you know, keep the secret. Yeah.
The Volturi, yes.
We're going to keep the secret and we're all going to abide by these sort of rules to maintain the secrecy. And I wish there was more context about what was going on between muggles and wizards at that time. Like, how did muggles feel victimized? How did wizards feel victimized? To get further context of where that perception of wizards are the oppressed, because they're the ones who have to like tiptoe around muggles all the time.
That is a good book that you should write, maybe.
Or maybe that couldn't be my leaky con presentation.
There you go. Cool. That would be lovely.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, any other thoughts about the air sign in relation to these chapters?
I think it's good to know that Dumbledore is an air sign, and I feel like it was applicable mostly to him in these chapters. Even though he's not living, he's still a presence, obviously.
Of course, like Ned Stark.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And because certainly Hermione's all earth, Virgo, sun and moon. Harry is all fire. Yes. And even Ron is water with Pisces. So like the only sign not represented in the Golden Trio is air.
Well, thanks, Ron, for making us all look bad as a very, very strong water sign person.
Alrighty then. And then we move on to our final exercise, which is fan fiction time.
I don't really have a good fan fiction this week. Because the only thing that I could think of kind of off the top of my head is like, what if Harry's wand didn't break? And I feel like I don't fully understand the repercussions of the breaking or what's going to happen there. So I feel like that's kind of a small thing. It's not a small thing. I should take that back. It's a big thing in the story. But the detail and the kind of consequences of that have not yet been really fully explored.
Yeah, because one thing to consider is obviously a wand is a huge type of identifier to a wizard. So like, so people aren't going to immediately know who he is now, technically, possibly.
Based on solely on his...
Well, just, you know, it's like, Harry can't... He's like, I can't cast Patronus in the ministry because my Patronus is a stag and everyone knows whose Patronus is a stag. So if those certain people are paying attention, they can recognize wands.
So that makes me think of something. I know that like everybody has a Patronus. Yours is, what is your Patronus? I forget.
A raven.
Yours is a raven.
Edgar Allan Poe, man.
There we go. Mine's a beagle. Whatever. At least it's not a salmon like that one guy. But does it, so it's related to the person, but I feel like, is it a little bit related to the wand too? Like,
getting a little too meta for me this late.
Okay. All right. Well, so that was kind of the best I could do with the,
I feel like it could in the sense that, you know, like Patronuses are very much shaped by the wizard's personality. So too is a wand, and what wand chooses them is based on personality and specific strengths and weaknesses.
Is there any effect of the wand breakage on the, it's like counter, you know, friend wand?
Yeah.
That's a stupid way to say it. I don't know.
I don't really know, but yeah, I'm trying to think what else. Yeah, because I'm just thinking about wands in terms of recognition, because if I ever write my stupid, Harry Potter fan fiction of Harry Potter's twin sister, there is a little bit of disguise involved, and a few people can recognize someone when they're in disguise because they recognize the wand.
Ah, okay. Wow, that's really interesting. Well, so what was yours? Mine, I don't know. I'm calling this week I didn't do a great job.
Yeah. You know, would Harry have been able to deal with the blow of his wand if they had actually managed to kill Nagini? Because it's such a missed opportunity. Because it's not, obviously, you know, they're just, you know, reacting to a very high stakes, you know, life-death situation.
Right.
But it's the sense of, you know, they already are, it's not like they're just piecing it together, oh, Nagini, and later they figure out Nagini is a Horcrux. Like, they're operating under the premise that Dumbledore highly suspected that Nagini is a Horcrux. And so, you know, not seizing upon that to just do away with her. Because if anything, in some ways, Nagini is the easiest Horcrux to kill.
Yeah.
Because all the other Horcruxes are inanimate objects that are magically protected and have to be destroyed with only very certain substances by the nature of them being like borderline indestructible. But Nagini being a living thing, if you just kill Nagini with like a killing curse, if you just kill her bodily, then the Horcrux will be destroyed. So in that way, getting rid of Nagini as a Horcrux is substantially easier.
Yeah. Interesting.
So and still they blew it.
They did.
Again.
They were
I blame Harry for that because, you know, Harry could have, because Hermione, there's no way, again, Harry is struggling with the snake. There's no way she could, like, put a killing curse and, you know, she might hit Harry. But Harry could have done a killing curse when Nagini attached herself to his arm.
Yeah. I'm just thinking about why didn't she take him? Oh, we talked about that because Voldemort wants to finish the job. So she couldn't take him out.
Because he's a fucking drama queen. That's why.
He is a drama queen. Everybody in this, Harry's kind of taken a freaking note from him in this last chapter. He needs to stop. If I was Hermione, I would say, like, stop acting like Voldemort. I don't know. Anyway, Harry's driving me nuts. Interesting.
Yeah. And then I think my only other one in my notes, which I think we kind of touched upon, is like, and what if Double D had told Harry some of this stuff so it wouldn't have been such a shock?
Well, Harry wouldn't have thrown a freaking hissy fit about it, which would have been great. I don't see the thing is, like, would that information like have stuck with him though?
Yeah. I don't know, because it's not even just about, oh, this terrible thing, like the thing I'm fighting against, he used to be like support and things like that. He's been bitching about Dumbledore since the beginning, already resenting Dumbledore. Why didn't Dumbledore take me to Godric's Hollow? We could have gone visit our graves together. It would have been a nice outing. So he's like, he's just in general really pissed the fact that, you know, that Dumbledore didn't like treat him more like a family member than, yeah. You know, so it's not even about this. Again, even with for the mundane stuff, it's like, why didn't he tell me this? Why didn't he tell me that? So he's dealing with the, I thought our relationship was closer when it's clearly not. And of course I've dealt, I've had situations, you know, situations like that where, whether it's romantically or with platonic friends, of where you think you're really close with someone, then it's like, oh, actually you're not. And it's like, it sucks.
Yeah, sure. I'm thinking about,
or may, if not directly telling Harry about like, oh, the greater good, I was like this anti-Muggle bigot. If Dumbledore had given Harry what he thinks he wants in terms of them having a closer relationship, if he had done all those like inconsequential things that Harry like is theorizing about or like fantasizing about, would he be more forgiving of finding out this kind of big thing about him?
Maybe. I don't know. I feel like with Dumbledore and their relationship, I mean, I feel like if I had, my husband's grandfather was a man who liked to tell stories, mm-hmm. you know, and he told a lot of stories. He was a World War II vet, told a lot of stories. Some people would say, oh my gosh, I don't want to like sit next to him at dinner because like, he'll just ramble. Whereas my husband was like, I'm going to listen to this man's story. I feel like Dumbledore could have been the rambling old man if he would have told Harry all of this, you know, and sometimes you know, that it's a matter of perception, and Dumbledore definitely played things close to the vest. God, I had a point that something related to Dumbledore and Harry. I don't remember. This job is killing my memory.
Losing a few brain cells day by day.
I remember, thank God. I feel like Harry's doing some sort of like psychological gymnastics to be like, everything he did is wrong because he's very hurt and he's very sad and Dumbledore didn't stick around, you know, because I don't hear him a lot of, we have not read a lot of him being like, F Snape, what an asshole. Like, I'm so mad at him. It's all like, Dumbledore didn't tell me that. Maybe it's because it's like the less, I feel like the route that he's taking, it's deflecting hurt by yeah. just accusing Dumbledore of being like,
yeah, of abandoning him because certainly if Dumbledore was alive, let's say Dumbledore was alive and some of this less savory elements of his past came out, you know, the way Harry seemed okay with the relationship with him and Dumbledore, he might have been surprised, but he wouldn't be like hurt because it's like, okay, you know, he's the most powerful wizard. He's not going anywhere. He can tell me this stuff, you know, later right. when we're not fighting a war, but because he's not there and, you know, time is finite. Why didn't he do any of this with me?
Yeah. I think it's a deflection. I think he's hurt that Dumbledore is gone. And rather than, you know, admitting that it's just easier to be pissed at him for not telling him things.
Yeah. Alrighty then, and thus concludes this episode of Rambling Raven Pups, rambling always as always. And tune in next week and we'll go into chapters 19 and 20, The Silver Doe and Xenophilius Lovegood.
Ooh.
A return to Luna's dad.
Awesome.
Which, as we know, like, was wearing that symbol that Victor Krum wanted to punch him in the face over.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm like, give me the Nazi. I want to punch him.
I guess we'll learn why, maybe. Who knows?
Yeah. All right, then. Catch all you guys later. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Rambling Raven Puffs. Our theme music was composed by John Williams, recreated by Kinez Norwar. This podcast is but one of the many shows produced by Sophie Mare Studios. You can get the latest news by following our social media, Sophie Mare Studios on Instagram, Sophie Mare Studios on TikTok, and SophieMare_pods on Twitter. You can connect with other listeners through the Sophie Mare Studios Discord server. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/SophieMareStudios, all lowercase. Higher tiers get access to even cooler perks.
That was the Sophie Mare Studios podcast.